Every now and then here in chapel, we have an opportunity to hear from someone who is changing the world in a quiet yet significant way. I've been hoping that my friend Lynn Hybels would be able to be with us for a long time, and this morning is that morning. Let me tell you something about her. Lynn was the co-founder of Willow Creek Church here in Chicago, but today she does not work on its staff. Instead, God has given her a heart for justice issues around the world, and this has taken her to Africa, Latin America, and Israel-Palestine. Today, she is working on comprehensive immigration reform in the U.S. All of it is courageous, and it's at the front edge of what God would have us do in the world today. Lynn became well known with her book that has the best title of any book I have ever seen, Nice Girls Don't Change the World. Lynn is not a nice girl. In fact, she's dangerous. She has a creed that she wrote called the Dangerous Woman Creed that has been used widely by dangerous women all over the world. Here are a few lines from it. Dear God, please make us dangerous women. May we be healers of wounds and righters of wrongs. May we weep with those who weep and speak for those who cannot speak for themselves. May we never hesitate to let passion push us and conviction compel us, and righteous anger energize us. May we strike fear into all that is unjust and evil in this world. May we overflow with goodness in the name of God and by the power of Jesus. And in that name and by that power, may we change the world. God, please make us dangerous women. Google that one. You really have to. Dangerous Woman Creed. It is amazing. Read the whole thing. Dangerous Woman is such a great title. It is totally tattoo worthy. In fact, I can think of a half dozen young women right now who ought to be wearing that one. The cultural anthropologist Margaret Mead once wrote, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world." Lynn Hybels rewrote that sentence like this, quote, "Never doubt that a community of thoughtful, committed women, filled with the power and love of God, using gifts they have identified and developed, and pursuing passions planted in them by God, never doubt that these women can change the world." Lynn Hybels is one of those women, and there are thousands of like her in the world, and some of you are and will be among them. She is dangerous, and she is passionate. She is not one of those stereotypical nice girls, and you are going to like her immediately. Let's give her an awesome Wheaton College welcome.
I think I should just let Gary give my talk. He's on such a roll. I appreciate that, and you need to know I like Gary, but he exaggerates so much, and I am not nearly as dangerous as he says I am. However, I think I might open a tattoo shop. What do you think? So, and one, you might want a dangerous man tattoo. Okay. Actually, Gary and I share many of the same concerns in the world, and I'm really glad that we can be colleagues who cheer one another on. And also, we just figured out that Gary's been doing some teaching at Willow Creek for almost 20 years. He joins us, and we are so thankful to have him there. So I want to give a talk based on the idea of the Prince of Peace today, and I will just jump right into that now. Years ago, I received a Christian card with a quote on the front of it by the 15th century German Christian mystic Meister Eckhart, and it says this, "What good is it to me if Mary gave birth to the Son of God 1,400 years ago, and I do not also give birth to the Son of God in my time and in my culture?" And that question, which I still have on this Christmas card that I put on my desk every year, it challenges and inspires me every December. Now, certainly, I do not wish to deny or diminish the miracle of Jesus' first advent when he was birthed in the flesh by the Virgin Mary. And nor do I wish to deny or diminish the future miracle of Jesus' second advent that is awaited by all creation. But I do believe that in between those major miraculous advents, we are all called to our own little advents, our own little miracles, when the Spirit of Christ implants itself more deeply in us, so that in our own little way, we can incarnate Jesus in the world that we've been called to. And for me, the weeks leading up to Christmas annually beckon me to reflect on what it means for me, in my own flawed and frail way, to incarnate Jesus. And increasingly, that reflection has focused on Isaiah's messianic vision of the one who is called the Prince of Peace. And to explain why I'm so drawn to that particular vision of Jesus, I'm going to start with a few personal stories. As most of you probably know, in the early 90s, a horrible war took place in Eastern Europe as the former Yugoslavia crumbled. It was a vicious war, complete with ethnic cleansing and atrocious crimes against humanity. Soldiers would enter a village, rape all the women, and take away all the men and the boys over age 13, and most of them never returned to their villages alive. In fact, most of them ended up in mass graves. Twice during that war, I traveled with a Christian NGO to Croatia and Bosnia. We visited refugee centers filled with middle-class women, just like me and my friends, who had lost everything: jobs, husbands, homes, their plan for future. And we visited schools where social workers tried to help kids who had watched their parents die when shells fell right into their homes. And these kids suffered so severely from post-traumatic stress that they just sat all day staring blankly and just silently chewing their fingernails, trapped in their own little place of pain and horror. And then we walked through the rubble of entire villages that had been crumbled, stumbling over the scattered remnants of daily life: a broken teacup, a scuffed shoe, a tattered doll. And it was the first time that I had seen war up close, and I was stunned by what human beings can do to each other. But that wasn't the last time that I saw war. Years later, I walked through the villages of Eastern Congo, where the deadliest war since World War II has claimed almost 6 million lives, and where rape as a weapon of war has brutally violated tens of thousands of women and girls. Women and girls whose stories I heard and with whom I wept. And despite formal peace treaties and international agreements, that war still rages today, both in rural villages and in women's bodies. More recently, last May, I sat on a concrete floor in a dilapidated apartment in Amman, Jordan, with Syrian refugee women whose empty eyes told the silent story of their losses and their grief. Since the Syrian war started in the spring of 2011, 3 million Syrians have fled from their homes, seeking safety in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, and other places. And another 6 million Syrians have been forced to flee from their homes, fleeing violence, and yet they're still within the boundaries of their country, literally running for their lives in an active war zone. And what that means is that, as of today, nearly one half of Syria's entire population has been displaced by war. One half of the population displaced, and nobody sees an end to this war. And now those refugees have been joined by Iraqis fleeing ISIS, Christians, Muslims, men, women, and children who have traded their homes and their schools and their jobs and their friends and their dreams for a steady stream of nightmares. The UN estimates that fully 1 million Syrians and Iraqis are currently facing the freezing temperatures of winter without the basic necessities of shelter, food, and warm clothing, and all because of the violence of war. For the last 6 years, I've also traveled repeatedly to Israel and to the West Bank, looking for and finding people of peace, people committed to reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians, and between Christians, Muslims, and Jews. And as you know, the last few months have been hard ones for peacemakers in the Holy Land. Last July, during the war in Gaza, I spent hours at my computer waiting from word for word from friends from the region, and it was a horrific time of grief and suffering and death for many people there. While I never consciously decided to begin spending time in war zones, that seems to be where I was led, and I continue to be so. And along the way, I have learned several key lessons, and that's what I'd like to share with you this morning. The first lesson I learned is that violent conflict has the capacity to destroy everything, from the body of the tiniest baby to the infrastructure of an entire society. In recent decades, many American Christians have become convinced that acts of compassion and the fight for justice are central to what it means to follow Jesus. And many churches are leading the way as agents of holistic transformation in communities throughout the world, living out the kingdom of God in beautifully practical ways. And that's all good. It's all wonderful. But it's not enough. Because if there is a war, if there is violent conflict, whatever good we've done will be undone. Violent conflict turns the greatest of our good deeds into nothing, and our most earnest gains for justice are lost. Where violence reigns, poverty is a given, human trafficking flourishes, abuse of women is guaranteed, diseases ravage, the displaced lose everything, and hope dies. So if we care about any of those great global tragedies, we have to also care about waging peace. The second thing I learned is that what happens on the grassroots level matters more than we think. I used to believe that the most significant dimension of peacemaking happened on the national or the international level. But what I've discovered is that while political powers can declare ceasefires and can create temporary solutions if they have the will to do so, those ceasefires and those solutions can only lead to a sustained peace if they're built upon a foundation of grassroots peacemaking and reconciliation. Even in a conflict as seemingly intractable as the one in the Holy Land, grassroots peacemakers are now, even now, offering a path toward peace. My Israeli Jewish friend Robbie Damelin and my Palestinian Muslim friend Bassam Aramin each lost a child to the conflict. Not wanting other families to suffer as they have suffered, they speak together in schools, in churches, and in civil organizations in the Holy Land and throughout the world, representing a growing group of bereaved Israeli and Palestinian parents who grieve together, share their stories with one another, tap into the deep well of human empathy, and then work together for reconciliation and peace. And while political leaders continue to bring nothing but disappointment to the Holy Land, people like Robbie and Bassam and hundreds of others like them, whose voices we don't hear about on the news, are showing up day after day, slowly building bridges of empathy, understanding, and friendship. And I believe that one of the most important things that we can do for the sake of peace is to get to know the people like that and to lift up their voices. Just weeks ago, I was in Israel and in the West Bank again with a group from my church. And toward the end of that trip, the violence began escalating in Jerusalem, as you probably heard, and sadly, that is continuing to do so. But one of the meetings that I had during that trip was with a group of young Israeli and Palestinian women who are so fed up with the rhetoric of racial hatred and violence coming from both of their communities that they started a website where their voices, the voices of young women seeking peace in the midst of conflict, a place where their voices can be heard. And I'm so proud of them and so hopeful because of people like them. But this last weekend, I learned from one of them that a school where her young children goes to school in Jerusalem was set on fire by an arsonist who also covered the school walls with anti-Arab graffiti. The school is a bilingual school where Jewish and Arab children study together and where Jewish and Arab parents advocate together for mutual coexistence in a shared Jerusalem. But now, while school books burn in a first grade classroom, hundreds of Jerusalemites, Jews and Arabs, are gathering outside that school to protest the racial hatred and the violence and to say, we refuse to be enemies, and we will continue to refuse to be enemies. John Paul Lederach, director of the Kroc Institute for International Peace at Notre Dame, wrote a beautiful book called Moral Imagination, The Art and Soul of Peacemaking. And he defines moral imagination as the capacity to imagine ourselves in a web of relationships that includes our enemies. Moral imagination is the capacity to imagine ourselves in a web of relationships that includes our enemies. In Jerusalem today, and in many places throughout the world, there are those who have no imagination, who cannot see beyond the violence in their past and in their present and in their projected future. But there are also those with great and beautiful moral imaginations, like the young women I met just 3 weeks ago, who can view Jerusalem, even Jerusalem, as a place of peace for former enemies. And people like that are courageously and consistently speaking truth to power. And they are peacemakers, they are heroes, and they give me hope. The third thing I learned is that peacemaking is not passive. It requires action. Psalm 34:14 says, turn from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The psalmist doesn't suggest that we think about peace, or that we reflect on the niceness of peace, or that we consider how much better peace would be than war. The psalmist says, seek it, pursue it, go after it, take action. And then in Luke 19, we read that as Jesus approached Jerusalem, he was grieved about the city, and he began to weep over the city. And in verse 42, he said, if you had only known this day the things that make for peace, if you had only known, but now they're hidden from your eyes. So according to Jesus, there are things that make for peace. Now, what are those things? I've been asking that question very seriously for the last few years, and I've found some really good answers. Some years ago, the late Glenn Stassen edited a book called Just Peacemaking that highlights 10 key practices of peacemaking that have been developing ever since World War II and that have worked effectively in many places in the world to eliminate potential wars, halt terrorism, and spread peace. Some of the practices are specific peacemaking initiatives that bring people together in mediation and conflict resolution. As one of my Israeli friends says, the violent won't stop until we talk. And so peacemakers take the initiative to create spaces where people from opposing sides can meet and where they can hear one another's stories and begin to understand and have empathy. A year ago in Washington, D.C., I had the great privilege of meeting with a gathering of American and Israeli and Palestinian women. And some of the women from Israel and Palestine came hesitantly, and they came with fear. But in that day and a half that we spent together, the women began to tell their stories, and they began to weep with one another and understand what the other was experiencing. And it was magic. It was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. There is so much power in creating spaces of meeting for people. Other practices include supporting direct nonviolent action like protests and marches and boycotts. Ron Sider just wrote a brilliant book calling Christians to a more aggressive and organized use of nonviolent resistance. Far more than we think has been and could be accomplished through nonviolent means if we just took that path more seriously. Other practices are focused on addressing violations of human rights and religious freedom and economic disparity, because the seeds of peace cannot grow in the soils of injustice. So working for justice is an active way of seeking peace. There are also two practices that I've learned personally as I've engaged in the Holy Land. And the first is the importance of listening to and honoring dual narratives. There is never just one true story in any conflict. There's more than one story, and we need to listen to them and honor them. Second, I've also learned the importance of honoring complexity, of expanding our minds enough to grasp that complexity so that we don't slide into simplistic pseudo-solutions that don't do anybody any good. And you know, what's interesting is that all of these principles are universal. They can apply to Eastern Congo, to Jerusalem, to Ferguson, to Chicago, to our own communities and our own homes. Yes, the violence in our world seems overwhelming, but we don't have the luxury of throwing up our hands in despair and doing nothing. There are things that make for peace, and we are called to know them and to do them. The fourth thing I learned is that the call to peacemaking is a call to rigorous and costly discipleship. Nothing has humbled me as much as spending time with true peacemakers. Time and again, I've been chastised. I've been broken by the gentle example of men and women for whom loving their enemies could literally cost them their lives. These are people who know about vulnerability and empathy and forgiveness and reconciliation in ways that I can't even imagine. And I look at them and I see how petty I am. I see how quick I am to pick sides and go for easy answers. How often I operate from anger rather than love, and how unlike the Prince of Peace I really am. In his book called Reconcile, John Paul Lederach suggests that the main thing Jesus brought to his role as a peacemaker was his presence. There was something in his presence, something in who he was and how he showed up, that made the way of peace more likely. I think that something that was in Jesus is what the world needs to see in his followers today. I think it's what the world needs to see born in us during this very season of Advent in 2014. In the aftermath of the Gaza war, a friend from Bethlehem who has been engaged in nonviolence and reconciliation for many years wrote these words to me. When all the dead are buried and the dust settles, a truer and deeper kind of peace needs to rise up from the rubble of the Holy Land. Not a peace that depends on the decisions of politicians or that trips off the tongues of activists, but a peace that bubbles up from the spring of God's love as it fills us. And to quote author Brian Zahn, as that love pulls us beyond the limits of our own self-interest to a place where we can see the world as God sees it. That's what Jesus had that we so desperately need. A connection with the love of God that is so deep, so broad, and so strong that it can pull us beyond the limits of our own self-interest so that we can see the world as God sees it. Seeing the world as God sees it, where even our enemy is a person made in the image of God and for whom Christ died, does not come naturally to us. I think it only comes through a journey of transformation grounded in prayer and silence and confession and humility and deep immersion into the words and the ways of Jesus. Peace demands a commitment for us to be broken and then remade into a purified vessel that can carry the peace of God into the world. I want to leave you today with a challenge. There are voices for peace rising up from many different directions in the American Evangelical Church at this time. I'm hearing them in conversations, I'm reading them on websites, and I'm endorsing them in unpublished manuscripts. And I've come to believe that peacemaking really is the cutting edge of American Christian discipleship in the 21st century. I believe it's time for the American church to become a peace church, to become so committed to doing the things that make for peace that the world will be astonished. That people outside the church will say, "Who are these people? What makes them so loving and brave and countercultural? Why are they walking through the war zones of Eastern Congo or the south side of Chicago? Why are they getting their hands dirty and maybe even putting their lives on the line for the sake of peace? Who are these people?" And I want to be able to say, for example, "Oh, those are Wheaton College students. They're smart. They've taken the time to learn about the things that make for peace. And they're creative. They have the moral imagination to envision a future in which enemies will become friends. And they're patient. They know that creating the soil of justice in which the seeds of peace can grow takes time. But they're not giving up because they're deeply spiritual. In quiet moments of prayer and confession, they have allowed the Spirit of God to purify them and to pull them beyond the limit of their own self-interest so that they can see the world as he sees it." Yeah, those are Wheaton College students. They're followers of the Prince of Peace. And may that be so. I pray that it will be so for you. And now I dismiss you to walk out into the world as peacemakers. Thank you.